Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. It's been 84 years since President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, an order to forcibly remove people who were deemed a threat to national security to war relocation centers. This mass incarceration led to the internment of an estimated 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans, about 70,000 of them U.S. citizens, into concentration camps. EO 9066 broke up families who lost their homes, businesses, and belongings. It also left a deep legacy among generations of Japanese Americans after. The traveling art exhibition, Resilience, A Sansei Sense of Legacy, presents a curation of works that explore that experience, its lasting effects, and its relevance to other chapters of American history that include the present day. Resilience is showing now through April 4th at the St. Louis Kaplan Feldman Holocaust Museum. Joining us now to talk about the exhibition and its connection to the history of Japanese Americans in the St. Louis region, we have three guests. First, we have Wendy Roll. Wendy is the current president of the St. Louis chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, or JACL. She also spent many years growing up in and living in the St. Louis area. Wendy, thank you for coming to talk with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We also have Christine Aono, who's one of the artists whose work is part of the Resilience Exhibition's core collection. Christine is a Chicago native who earned her Bachelor's of Fine Arts at Washington University. Welcome, Christine, and thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And last, but certainly not least, we have Amy Ozawa. Amy's uncle, Arthur Tawada, spent more than 65 years making his life and art in Alton, Illinois. A selection of Tawada's art is part of the St. Louis showing of the Resilience exhibition. Amy, thank you, too, for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So, Wendy, I'd like to begin with you and get a little bit of background about how Japanese Americans came to St. Louis. But can you talk a bit about the way your own family arrived and settled down here as a way of understanding that?
Oh, absolutely. And there are many different stories about how people came to St. Louis. But one of the most common stories you'll hear is one of the incarceration camps that people were shipped off to. Two of them were actually in Arkansas, which is the closest site to St. Louis. And in order to leave the camp after the war, you had to have a job. And so St. Louis welcomed people to come from out of those camps. And then also Washington University and St. Louis University allowed people to come out of those camps and study. So some of the noted architects and doctors in the St. Louis area were all educated, and they got out of those camps because the universities would take them.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my case, my father's family was in Roer, Arkansas, which was one of the camps in Arkansas. And after the war, the head of the household got a job. He was in his 50s. He got a job in Peavely. But then a lot of the other family, they ended up working in St. Louis. So that side of my family came to St. Louis that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then on my mother's side, they were in a camp called Tule Lake, which is way up at the border of California and Oregon. And my grandfather, got a job with the Army, even though he was a Japanese citizen. So he got a job with the Army, and then he ended up working at the Defense Mapping Agency and came here to St. Louis with his family that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, Christine, I understand that you also have that connection with the Arkansas camps, yes?
Yes, I do. My mother's family was originally from Fresno, California, and they were incarcerated first at Jerome, which is one of the Arkansas camps, and they were there until Jerome closed and then spent the last few months at Roer. My family is from Chicago, and the U.S. government at the time of the closing of the camps deliberately made an effort to disperse the Japanese communities. So they didn't want the Japanese Americans to move back to the West Coast, and they found ways to sort of advertise that the Midwest was a welcoming place. And Chicago was one of those places. So that the population of Japanese Americans in Chicago just exploded. Before the war, there were less than 400. And then in a census of 1994-95, the population was around 20,000. So that effort to disperse the Japanese population from the West Coast was somewhat successful. After around the 1950s, many of those Japanese Americans had moved back to the West Coast, but there is a strong Japanese American presence in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Now, Amy, I understand that you are also from Chicago. Is any of that also part of the, you know, the family history for you, what we've just heard?
So the family history that I heard, my grandparents were interned in Manzanar, and after the internment, they traveled to the Chicago area. My grandfather traveled beyond that to New York area to Seabrook, I believe, and then came back to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
The children were caught up in Japan during the war. They were sent back for schooling. They were all very young, sent back for schooling, and then they, when the war broke out, they couldn't come back to the United States till after the war.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of movement around the country, but this mm-hmm. history of Japanese Americans in the Midwest is certainly something that I learned about in preparing for this conversation. Now, with your uncle, Amy, Arthur Tawada, he also came to the St. Louis area, and specifically to Southern Illinois. And he was a prolific and esteemed ceramicist and painter.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about how he came to this part of the Midwest and what he did here?
So he and his mother and brother traveled back to Japan after internment, and they lived there for a few years. Then he came back to the United States, joined the U.S. Air Force, and in doing so, he had connections to bring the rest of his family over, and he was at Scott's Air Force Base.
Mm.
Oh, well, he was at another Air Force Base, I think in Colorado first, and then Scott's Air Force Base after that. And then once he left the U.S. Air Force, he enrolled in college, Southern Illinois University. So he had a family that sponsored him, and he loved the area.
Yeah,
and
yes, please go ahead.
Oh no, he stayed and he took classes and found that he loved the art and artwork, and he dabbled in everything: ceramics, watercolor, acrylics, and oils.
Mm-hmm. Wendy, do you know whether St. Louis was billed as welcoming in the same way Chicago was?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think people were already here because of the universities. And so, people knew that it was a friendly place. I mean, all these stops are along the train,
mm-hmm.
right? So people came along that way, and that's kind of how they were displaced after the war.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, absolutely. I think they had a wonderful reputation. There is a story, I don't know if it's actually true, but there was a story that people on their way to Chicago even left and came to St. Louis before they hit Chicago, because at the train station, people were welcoming of folks that were coming out of the camps.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, Wendy, here in St. Louis, what did members of the Japanese American community here talk about or connect over when it came to the internment? I mean, was that experience, a significant or explicit part of what people connected over with one another?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, it was cultural and a shared experience. You know, everybody, you know, how in St. Louis you talk about where did you go to high school? Mm-hmm. Well, if you meet a Japanese American, sometimes you eventually ask them where their families were interned, right? So there's a whole language there amongst that community. And I think that was really a way for them to feel at home in a new place, mm-hmm. was for them to all connect over this. I will say that my grandparents didn't talk a lot about it, but I think, you know, there was a shared understanding amongst the community members.
Yeah. Christine, how similar was your experience of Japanese American community and sort of openness to talking about what happened during that period of incarceration?
I think what Wendy said is it really resonates with me, because I think a lot of us Sansei, that's third generation, who had not experienced the camps but had parents who had a very similar experience, and that is that our parents didn't talk about it. Most of our parents were young and children, and they grew up with this sort of belief that somehow they had done something wrong. The incarceration of Japanese Americans happened because they had somehow deserved to be put there, and, you know, which is an awful thing to put on children. So I think my parents were very typical of their generation in that they raised their children to be very American. We didn't learn Japanese. They wanted to make sure that there was no question of our being American, which is really a sad thought when you think about how much culture can get disappeared just with language disappearing. But my parents, when my sisters and brother were growing up, my parents would mention camp, and we always thought that they had gone to summer camp. Mm. And it wasn't until my brother, who's the oldest, was in U.S. history class in high school and saw like one line in the textbook mentioning the camps. And then my brother asked my parents about it, and then we found out what camp was. And I think that that was a very typical experience for the Sansei. But what really became a very cathartic moment for the Japanese Americans in this country was the act of redress and the whole happening of how that occurred. And it started with the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, which is known as the CWRIC. And those were congressional hearings that started in 1981. It was actually an act that was formed by President Jimmy Carter in 1980, but there were 10 hearings across the U.S. where former incarcerees were finally given a chance to tell their stories of what happened. And that was a moment of just kind of opening up conversations between generations that was really, really vital to the Japanese American community. And that led to the Civil Rights Act, the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which was signed by, I want to make sure I have this right, it was signed by Reagan, President
yes,
Reagan.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And But that was a really important moment in our community for just having the Issei and Nisei finally speak.
Mm-hmm. That government acknowledgement must have been huge.
There was an apology in the letter. You know, we are sorry that this happened. It was wrong. And my dad said that was probably the most important part of the redress, was the apology and the recognition that was wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a good spot for us to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation about the legacy of the mass incarceration of Japanese and Japanese Americans during World War II and a traveling art exhibition with St. Louis Region Connections that explores the internment's generational effects. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation about the legacy of the World War II incarceration of Japanese and Japanese Americans. We're talking today with three guests, Wendy Roll, Amy Ozawa, and Christine Aono. There is a now running visiting art exhibition at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum that is called Resilience, a Sansei Sense of Legacy, and that is open until April 4th. Now, before the break, we were talking about Japanese American community, how it has built up in different parts of the Midwest, St. Louis, as well as Chicago, and some of the ways that government acknowledgement and apology impacted particularly those who had experienced that incarceration firsthand. And this this traveling exhibition, Resilience, there is an inspiration that lies with one of our guests today, Christine. Christine, can you talk with us about the origin of this exhibition and why it felt like such an important thing to do?
Sure. In 2016, shortly after the presidential election, you probably all remember how people were being detained when they were coming into the country or leaving the country at airports. And a lot of lawyers, a lot of protesters went to the airports to try to help these people who were being wrongfully detained. And there is a curator named Gail Enns, who I have known for quite a long time. And she called me up and said, "Christine, we have to do something about this. This is history repeating itself." And I said, it sure sounds like it. And she said, she kept talking about how people needed to know that this happened before in history. And it was the camps, the Japanese American camps during World War II. And she said, "Too many people don't know that this happened. We need to do a show that centers on that." And she was particularly thinking about a piece that I had done at the Long Beach Museum of Art in 1992, and I did a reiteration of it again at the Block Museum in at Northwestern University's campus in 2017. And so Gail curated this show, Resilience, along with a co-curator, Jerry Takigawa, who is also one of the artists in the show. And they put together the show of eight of us artists. So it's Jerry and myself and Reiko Fuji, Wendy Maruyama, Lydia Nakashima Degara, Tom Nakashima, George Shimomura, and Jerry Takigawa. Again, he's the co-curator. And I'm really proud to be in the show. It's a really interesting variety of artwork, but all centered on the topic of the Japanese American camps. We all take different avenues of expressing that story, but that is how this show evolved, was because of Gail saying that, you know, people need to know that this happened before and it's happening again.
Mm-hmm. Amy, you came to see the Resilience exhibition here in St. Louis, but you had first seen it in Chicago. Can you tell us how you felt seeing that exhibition in Chicago, and then what it was like to be asked to include some of your uncle's art in the St. Louis showing?
So in the museum in Skokie, it was a larger exhibit, and it was just amazing. all the photographs, all the artwork, the artists that contributed to that particular exhibit. And then coming to St. Louis, about a year ago, someone from JACL, Steve Matori, contacted me because I guess he knew my uncle and remembered some of his artwork, and I was just really honored to have his artwork displayed there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed the St. Louis exhibit. It was smaller. I had more time to sit and actually look at all the artwork and really appreciate it, and the video that played, I watched it a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy it.
The pieces that are on display, Arthur Tawada's pieces, there is a sculpture. It is stoneware, and it's Manzanar barbed wire pot. There are broken pieces. And I could not help but kind of zero in on the stand it's placed on has a little sign that says, please do not touch. I mean, and obviously it is not something that you wouldn't touch, but given what this history is and how it has not been touched in certain ways, it just, it resonated with me in a particular way. Wendy, you knew Arthur Tawada. He was quite a presence, not only in the Japanese American community, but in the larger art community. What was it like to see his work included here?
Well, we were so excited when Amy said, yes, we can have some of Art's work in the exhibit. Art was just such a great presence. He used to come every year to the Japanese festival and do pottery demonstrations and sell his work. And his work was so accessible and beautiful, but sometimes haunting. It meant so much for us to be able to include his and give the exhibit a local flavor as well. He was a fixture here for such a long time, and I just truly admired him.
Mm-hmm. I spoke with a friend, actually, whose husband grew up in Edwardsville, and he had no idea that Art Tawada was in Alton, and right there so close to where he was. And this friend also is Japanese-American, and her grandparents were interned. And much of what I learned came from her. Christine, what you had mentioned about your brother seeing that one line in a history book, that also is something that really stands out to me. You know, as we're talking about this executive order issued almost exactly 84 years ago, and the awareness that people have of it now, do you feel that there is greater awareness, or are many people still woefully unfamiliar with what happened at that time? Wendy?
I do feel there's a lot of educating we still need to be doing. And I think when I tell people, oh yeah, this happened to my parents, they're just shocked. You know, they're like, that was your parents? I'm like, it really wasn't that long ago.
Right, right.
You know, and I think when you see things in a history book, or even if you read it, you don't really understand that it's a personal story for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think we have a lot of educating still to do.
Mm-hmm. Christine, one of the pieces that is in Resilience is called Daruma of Resilience. Can you briefly share what a Daruma is? And why you wanted this piece to be part of the Resilience exhibition?
Yes. So a lot of my work is very participatory. It always has been. I'd like to invite the community to respond in some way. And for this particular exhibit, I wanted there to be more of a connection between past and present. And knowing the political climate that was forming, and this piece was made in 2021, I wanted a way to give people some sort of sense of hope. And a daruma is a Japanese trinket of sorts. It's usually made out of paper mache, and it's about the size of, a teacup or something. Mm-hmm. And people in Japan make, they buy these little figurines, and it is based on the story of Daruma, who is a Buddhist priest who, legend has it, he meditated so long that he lost the use of his arms and his legs, and he became this figure that would fall over but bounce back up. And so he's a symbol of resilience, of always trying and bouncing back up and righting yourself. So that is a figure that is used in Japanese culture to make a wish. So maybe on a birthday or on a specific, when you're working on some specific project, you will make a wish and draw in one eye. And when your wish comes true, you draw in the other eye. So that's what this big figure is. He has one eye drawn in, but he also has on him documents from history of acts of racism that were passed as law in America's history, and acts of bouncing back from them by other acts of law. So for instance, on the front of the Daruma, there's Executive Order 9066. And then on the other side of this, the front is the Civil Liberties Act and the letter of apology. So kind of showing people that there is hope, that this happens throughout history. Acts of racism and bigotry happen throughout history, and there are ways of bouncing back. So the other part of this piece is that people have a small sticky note of a drawing of a Daruma on it. I want them to participate by making their wishes, and they place those sticky notes on the Daruma. So hopefully by the end of the run of resilience in St. Louis, it will be filled with everyone's wishes.
Mm. As we close here, Wendy, you were part of the hosting committee that brought resilience, a sense of legacy to St. Louis. What is your wish for this exhibition and how it will add to our understanding of what is happening now?
Well, my wish is, well, for one thing, that people go and see it, and then they kind of look inside themselves and look externally too, and see whether or not any of those things are applicable today. And everybody interprets things differently, but I think that I really want people to start reflecting on what's happening now and the mistakes we've made in the past.
Mm-hmm. Wendy Roll is the current president of the St. Louis chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, and she also grew up here in St. Louis. Christine Aono is one of the artists whose work is part of the Resilience Exhibition's core collection, and Amy Ozawa is the niece of Arthur Tawada, who spent more than 65 years making his life and art in Alton, Illinois. Thank you, each of you, for joining us today. I really appreciate all that you've shared.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Resilience, a Sansei Sense of Legacy, is showing now through April 4th at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum. This special exhibition is free. For more information, visit stlholocaustmuseum.org.
This episode was produced by Elaine Cha with production assistance from Lila Halilbashich.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Doerr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
Thank you. The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.